Hi, this is the American Psychological Association's Division 15 podcast series on emerging research in educational psychology. My name is Jeff Green. Thanks for joining us. The more I study education and psychology, the more I realize the importance of being thoughtful about whether what I study differs in quantity or quality. Most of my initial training was in quantitative methods, so I tended to assume things that I studied differed in quantity. Some people have more self-efficacy than other people, or some people are less likely to use productive writing strategies than other people. But over the years, I've realized that in many cases, people differ in the quality or nature of their thinking. For example, qualitative research methods are needed to understand why some people think schools should focus on training people for the workplace, whereas other people think schools should focus on helping people self-actualize and be critical thinkers. Such differences are not in the quantity of their ideas, but rather their quality or nature. And in some cases, something we might have been thinking about in a quantitative way might be much better examined in a qualitative way. My guests today have made such an argument about culture. They have modeled culture as a way of thinking that influences how people comprehend texts, leading them to create a critical, culturalized comprehension framework. I'm excited to talk to them about their framework and how it can help us better understand how culture influences the quality, not just the quantity, of people's comprehension. Alex List is Associate Professor of Educational Psychology at Pennsylvania State University. Gala Campos Oaxaca and Bailing Liu are current graduate students also in the Educational Psychology program at Pennsylvania State University. Hong Sui, or Hani Du, is a postdoctoral researcher at the Florida Center for Reading Research. Ye-Yan Lee is a postdoctoral researcher at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Collectively, they are all focused on understanding students' learning from texts and other resources, particularly in digital contexts, and with specific attention to the higher-order cognitive processes involved. Within that, Gala is interested in source-based writing, particularly among graduate students. Hani studies evidence-based reasoning. Ye-Yan is working on the role of self-regulation in learning from multiple texts. Bailing is interested in students learning from statistical texts. And Alex is interested in all of that, to varying extents. Today, we're talking about their 2024 article in Educational Psychologist entitled Critical Culturalized Comprehension, Exploring Culture as Learners Thinking About Texts. So Alex, Gala, Hani, Ye-Yan, and Bailing, thank you for talking to me today, and thank you for writing this article.
Jeff, thank you so much for having us. It's really a pleasure to be here. And hopefully all of us will, I'm sure, get the chance to answer various questions. But I can start on behalf of all of us as co-authors by saying we're really happy to be here and really excited to be sharing this work.
Well, great. Thanks for being here. It's a great article and I'm excited to talk to you all about it. So I think to help our listeners get a good understanding of your framework, we need to define some terms. And the terms might be defined differently than maybe how some people are thinking about them. So let's start with comprehension. Bailing, how do you define comprehension of texts?
Yeah, so normally we define the comprehension of text as students' mental or reader's mental representation of the content that's described in the text. However, in our paper, we extend this definition into reader's mental representations of the text and their worldviews beyond the text content that described.
And so, Bailing, I think that's a really important point, right? That you're thinking about comprehension, not just about what people are learning from the text, but also kind of how they're bringing their own worldview to it. So how does your framework differ from other theories of comprehension?
I think in prior work, especially for the construct and instruction model, when they think about comprehension, they specify two types of like three or mental representations based on they call text-based or situational model. The text-based representation only focuses on the text information itself, and the situation model is like students construct a mental representation of the text information or the phenomena described in the text with their prior knowledge. For our models, we kind of attach based on the prior knowledge. Like students can detect text information with their prior knowledge, but also we not consider prior knowledge, or we use another word, culture at here, like include the terms prior knowledge, like culture schema, which we can call for the prior knowledge, and also how students using culture as a way of thinking to achieve a culturalized comprehension. So is beyond what's discussed in the prior text. So Alex, can you add more for that?
I think we can also Just thinking about it a little bit more broadly, I would say our model is a complement and maybe addition to prior models of comprehension, things like the construction integration framework that Bailing talked about when we're talking about single text comprehension, or something like the documents model framework when we're talking about multiple text comprehension. So really broadly, those models conceptualize reading as students' construction of a mental representation, which is a fancy way of saying when you read a text, so for example, if you read a storybook, you don't create a mirror image of that text word for word. You kind of have what's sometimes called a gist representation. So if you tell me about a storybook, you might tell me about a princess living in a castle. That's kind of a summary of what you read. And like Bailing said, it's integrated with students' prior knowledge. And so we really hold that idea of cognitive representations of texts as central in our model. But the way that we kind of push on that idea is to say that when you construct a cognitive representation of texts, it's not just representing that text, right? It also tends to be representing something about the real world. It helps you to build your understanding. And of course, if we're talking about a storybook, eventually kids develop a conception of fiction versus nonfiction. So we know that maybe it's not a real princess, but that princess still tells us something about the world and what we think is important. But with nonfiction texts, if we read about a topic like poverty or immigration in the newspaper, it does tell us something both about our world and our understanding of it and the author's understanding of it. And so part of getting at culture as a way of thinking, and I know we need to define culture probably as our next term, is really moving beyond students constructing just cognitive representations of texts to really thinking about when students construct those cognitive representations, what are they either explicitly or implicitly encoding about the world? And how does that change then their interactions with the world and with subsequent texts?
So that's a really important way of thinking about comprehension as not just accessing prior knowledge, but also accessing, Bailing, like you said, worldviews, and Alex, as you said, this kind of broader idea of the things that they bring to text. And that leads us to your definition of culture, which I found really intriguing. So Gala, can you talk to us a little bit about how your group defines culture?
Yeah, of course. We struggle a little bit because we did not want to be too general to say, hey, everything is culture. There's like the culture of sports. There's the culture we talk on the paper of like Halloween. That's not really what culture is. We're trying to see how we can include that into more of like a sociological phenomenon in which we kind of mediate our experiences, our constant exposure to some practices, to some ways of thinking into our way of seeing the world, right? Mm-hmm. So I think at some point Alex said, you don't know you are within a particular culture until you are outside of it. And we, all of us are international students. So we were like, I didn't know I was Mexican until I came to the United States. And, I am Mexican. And and this is my culture. So we were iterating about what it really meant for our background, our prior knowledge, our prior experiences to build our culture. And then how that culture that we built in influenced how we interpreted text and interpreted the word outside of us and mediate that. Alex, do you want to build up on our definition of culture?
Yeah, so to add to what Gala said, I think the way that we are conceptualizing culture that's perhaps a little bit different from prior work is we are thinking about culture as a way of thinking, which is kind of this phrase that appears a couple of times in the paper. But it comes from our understanding of prior research and kind of a divergence from it. So anybody who is a reading researcher or has read the scholarship knows that there is a well-established kind of older set of studies in comprehension research in educational psychology. I'm thinking about things like Stephenson and Anderson's work that does look at the role of culture in comprehension. And that's kind of where we started. But the way that they conceptualize culture is largely as an individual difference factor. So for example, my family is Eastern European Jewish, so that's kind of my box. That's my culture. And as we started with that, we found that that definition was really insufficient to capture how we actually interact with texts and the outcomes of that, and not really considering a lot of kind of modern scholarship beyond educational psychology, as well as within educational psychology, but things like sociocultural theory, culturally responsive pedagogy, a lot of Gay's work, a lot of Ladd to Billings' work in terms of thinking about what is students' more multidimensional experience of culture. And as we were trying to think about what is really culture within the context of comprehension, we came to this idea of culture as a way of thinking. So culture as much more active. So in a couple of different ways, when you read a text, that in itself is culture, how we read, when we read, the classroom context in which we read. And quite importantly for us, what you then take away from the text, be it its meaning or the fact that this was a text that was important enough to read in your classroom, or this was a text, but you really found it problematic and not comporting with your experiences, that takeaway is part of what defines culture as well. And so the approach that we take in the paper is really thinking about culture as much more dynamic, as a way of thinking, as the processing and outcome of students' interactions with texts.
And that's a real big change. And I think it's an important one. It's I think, one of the things that really drew me to your paper. So, Alice, can you talk to us a bit more about what it means for people to engage in culture as a way of thinking?
Yes, absolutely. So the way that we started to define culture as a way of thinking is by actually looking at the etymology of the word culture. And it's a comparatively recent term, as Gala mentioned. It's a sociological term that really emerged alongside and after the Industrial Revolution. It's a sociological term that really looks at kind of studying ourselves. And so taking that idea and to put it in more simply, anytime we say culture. So if we say, for example, the culture of podcasts, just adding the word culture makes us think about podcasts in a different way. It helps us redefine it. And so we started with that etymological kind of conception. And we break down what it means to think about culture in four main ways. So first, we think about culture as reasoning about commonalities. So when I say thinking about the culture of podcasts, automatically where your brain goes to, and that's kind of the culture as a way of thinking piece, is thinking about, well, what do podcasts have in common? And they tend to have, Jeff, in this case, you as maybe a talking head. And that role is something that's common across a lot of podcasts, for example. So that's one way to think about culture. Culture as commonality. Another way to think about culture is culture as divergence. And that's how we think about culture a lot in education. A lot of times when we talk about students' culture, and there's a great Ladd to Billings quote in the paper that satirizes that in particular, we think about specifically the experiences of students who are not white, not upper middle class in the classroom. So this is a big point that's also made in critical whiteness studies, is if we think about who has culture, a lot of times we use that as an othering, as opposed to kind of a white middle class student. We think of them as normative. So they have like this absence of culture. But of course, all of us have culture. And so a lot of times when we are cognizant of that is when we're thinking about difference, when we think about what we take to be normative, and we realize, oh, wait, that's different. Not everybody has dinner in the same way that I do. So culture as similarity, culture as divergence. We also think about culture as a way of thinking, as recognizing the values. So when I recognize that, oh, these podcasts have these things in common, or, oh, there's a difference between how my family eats dinner versus a different family eats dinner, I then need to think about those commonalities and divergence in terms of the why. Why do I think this emerges? And perhaps more importantly, what values do they reveal? So connecting the similarities and differences to an understanding of kind of what is prioritized, what's valued, what's viewed as quote unquote good. And the last component of culture as a way of thinking, and I think this particularly comes into place when we talk about texts, is also recognizing texts as cultural objects. So we have this tendency to think about texts as kind of, you know, they're reified, they exist often, not always, but often we think of them as disembodied in some way. There's something my teacher passed out in class, but also thinking about texts as cultural objects. So they are constructed by an author or authors, and so they are inherently limited and informed and enriched by what an author is bringing. They occur in a context of particular publication practices. They are disseminated and read in a variety of contexts, and all of those factors, and I think we have some examples in the paper, also inform kind of the cultured nature of texts as constructed works. So that's kind of the four ways we conceptualize culture in terms of recognizing commonality, thinking about difference, thinking about values, and at least in terms of texts, but other objects too, recognizing authored works. I don't know if Gawa, you have anything to add.
Yeah, just a little bit. I think it's also worth mentioning that culture as a way of thinking also involves a little bit of empathy and like knowing that me as a reader, I have a cultural background and it influences the way I process the text or the content, but also the author of whatever I'm reading or processing has a cultural background. And I was thinking a little bit about when I was reading about feminism, just like reading when feminism comes from different waves, right? So where is this author coming from? Where am I coming from? How my experiences are influencing how I'm interpreting this text. And just like understanding that we all come from different places and we all interpret things different. And that's all I wanted to add.
Well, it's so important, right? So I really like this framing of what you call culturalized comprehension. It's bringing a different lens to comprehension. You're kind of asking readers to think about, as you said, kind of commonalities and differences between their culture and the author's culture, or even the culture that's described in the text, and then having them kind of connect and evaluate with those things. And that's a different lens than I think some people might bring to text, but I think it's really helpful. So I'm hoping we can hear a little bit more about how you think about culturalized comprehension, and in particular, the role of deliberate reflection. Hey, Yayan, can you talk to us a little bit about deliberate reflection and how you think about it?
Yes, so you can usually think of it like a metacognitive processes, because I'm a really big fan of self-regulation and always focused on the lack of metacognition. So for culturalized comprehension context, and you can easily think of how people and how students actively recognizing they are engaging in culturalized comprehension or developing their personal understanding of author's text and real words, because these like the text and the like the real words are like the continuum. So it's not really like the completely exclusively distinguished at all. So this deliberate practice, or can be like a metacognitive processes, can serve as a epistemic function, or like the make students more epistemic agency in thinking about, in keep aware of they are engaging in the culturalized comprehension or constructing interpretation of text and the value reflected in the writing and the word. But at the same time, they are also considering the accuracy and truthfulness and completeness of their interpretation of text. And also like that, they are always possibility to have alternative like interpretation that can be deviated from the text itself. But this deliberate reflection is not only happen in the culturalized comprehension. When they think of the like the critical culturalized comprehension, which is try to make a counter-narratives and the counterintuitive explanation about the text, they are also engaging in the deliberate reflection processes, which means that they are trying to explore multiple perspectives that cannot be shown in the author's text, because some texts might be more consist of master narratives or dominant narratives, but some people may think about like the more counter narratives or like alternative narratives in their mind. So people try to generate counter narratives and they reorganize their epistemic agency to make a new message that might not show up in the text, or they may support the author's view in the text. So as such, this deliberate reflection process is to consider about whether their interpretation is correct, whether those are valid, or whether their such inferences from text can be like the correctly argued with like the new interpretations.
And to me, what Hyeon is saying really connects to Gala's point about empathy. And so it's this deliberate process of both recognizing that authors have a quote unquote culture that they are writing from and a culture that they're embedded in, and they're engaged in kind of culturalized processes. And so both recognizing that, but also realizing that we are only interpreting that. And so there's always some imperfections in our interpretation. And so having both, Jason Brash writes a lot about this idea of epistemic humility in when we try to interpret what authors are saying, and also kind of thinking about multiple explanations and allowing for that plurality, which I think Hyeon and Gala both touched on. And of course, a lot of us are multiple text researchers, and not to get too far into the implications, but one of the ideas that we propose is thinking about multiple texts and multiple perspectives as a way of trying to get at that multiplicity when we're trying to think about all of the different ways that we are interpreting what an author is saying and thinking about the quote-unquote accuracy of that interpretation.
So you've really laid out well both your ideas about culturalized comprehension and critical culturalized comprehension, right? So if I am approaching texts with a frame of thinking about commonalities and differences in our values and our worldviews of both myself and the author, that's culturalized comprehension. But then if someone were to start thinking about counter narratives and generating those counter narratives or critiques, that moves it into critical culturalized comprehension of texts. And Alex, can you give us an example of what that would look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we read texts, a well-established finding is we tend to kind of just assimilate them or kind of accept them into what we already know. And that's true for culturalized comprehension as well. So I might pay attention to similarities within a text or across texts or differences from my worldview. But it's very possible for me to read something and say, oh, okay, this is different, but this author is just introducing a different perspective. Culturalized comprehension is the idea that sometimes we reject the narrative that a text is introducing. So, for example, in the storybook princess example that I talked about before, we might take our culturalized comprehension to another level. And one of the examples, Kim et al. In the paper that we cite, does exactly this with, I believe, second graders. We might say, interesting that there's this storybook that's widely read for children, and the heroine is a princess. And what does that tell us about kind of who heroines are, and maybe about gender dynamics? And I have always thought it's an interesting that even in a democracy, we have this royalist biasing. But to take a more adult example, some of the most interesting examples come from Twitter, or now X, but formerly Twitter. And again, we cite some of this work in the paper, and particularly the narratives introduced by Black Twitter. So we started to conceptualize this paper in 2020 over the summer of racial justice and the Black Lives Matter movement. And there was a lot of conversations at the time on social media and elsewhere around how media was portraying race-based violence against Black people, what's called quote-unquote propaganda. For example, there were memes of which photo would you use, critiquing how often Black men, but people were represented when they were described as perpetrators or victims of crime, and the way that police violence, for example, was talked about in passive terms. That's still very much the case now. We can also think about this in relation to current reporting on the genocide in Gaza. I just saw some interesting reporting on the terms that are used for victims and whether Palestinians are children or adolescents or young, or kind of, again, the language that's used. And so we were really conscious of the idea that sometimes when you read a text, particularly when you come from a marginalized identity in the US, the normative narrative that's put forward is often marginalizing, right? So a lot of our quote-unquote mainstream media is, to varying extents, explicitly and implicitly racist, sexist, ableist, class-coded. And so a lot of times, the way that all kinds of issues, immigration, economic opportunity policing are reported on are really stigmatizing. And so in those cases, it's really important to be able to adopt counter narratives. And there's a lot of study of this in the communications literature and political science and education as well, of are you able to reframe the message that the text is putting forward, oftentimes to create a more affirming message. And we talk about the psychological or the cognitive processes that may be involved in that, and we refer to that as critical culturalized comprehension. So to put it more simply, it's this idea of creating a counter narrative, oftentimes in a more affirming way, in response to marginalizing texts.
And that's a really important distinction, right? Because people bring culture to both how they comprehend, but also how they critique. And you've really tied all three of those things together and highlighted that if you want to understand comprehension of multiple texts, you've got to understand how people are, or in some cases are not, bringing culture as a way of thinking and critical thinking as a way of thinking also. So that's really helpful. So it sounds like your framework, which you call the culturalized and critical culturalized comprehension or C4 framework, has a lot of implications for research and practice. So Hani, can you talk to us a little bit about the implications of your C4 framework?
Yes, of course. So I think there are definitely many implications that we can draw from this paper. And some of the major takeaways I would like to emphasize is that, so first of all, as we already discussed, so culture is a very complex construct. It has been defined in a variety of ways. And as Alex discussed before, when culture is examined in reading research, it is often viewed as the static knowledge or the schema that students bring into their reading. And what we want to emphasize in this paper is that we as researchers should focus more on fostering and assessing students' active construction of their personal and societal understanding when reading. We should focus on their recognition and their analysis of their own worldviews and that of the authors during their reading process, which we term as the culturalized comprehension and critical culturalized comprehension. Mm-hmm. And in relation to this, we also see a great need to develop curricular materials to support students' culturalized and critical culturalized comprehension. And we think that text-based curricular materials is particularly important in this case because text constitutes a very unique and important object that can be used as subject to culture, which we define as a way of thinking. And Alex also mentioned this before, we are multiple text researchers, and we think that the use of multiple texts provides a great opportunity to foster such culturalized and critical culturalized comprehension. Like if you introduce students with multiple texts about certain topics, this can help students to recognize the multitude of the interpretations that could exist, and also allow students to identify the commonalities and differences among these worldviews as described by the authors, and also help the students to recognize their own worldviews during the way of their reading and their further analysis of the underlying values this convey. So we think please use multiple texts when you're trying to help your students to develop their culturalized and critical culturalized comprehension.
Well, that's great. And, you know, the sign of a really good article is that there's a lot of implications for both the way that we teach and the way that we think about teaching and the way that we think about research. So I'm really excited to see what people do with the ideas in your paper, particularly this idea of culture as a way of thinking. So thanks so much for talking about your article. I really encourage our listeners to read it carefully. There's a lot there. It's really generative. And, you know, that's the kind of article that we look for in educational psychologists. So I'm wondering if, you know, Alex, if you have any advice for people who are trying to write or want to try to write an article for our journal.
I'll say the first piece of advice is to not be intimidated and not do it. I think particularly for more junior researchers, educational psychologists, and a theory article in general can feel intimidating. But in some ways, it's a lot easier to write than an empirical article. I'm putting easier in quotes. But in some ways, it's easier because it's really drawing on other people's research or your own as an empirical base, and then putting some ideas forward. And so it's about just being able to describe your ideas. You don't have to have a study conducted that worked and produced the effects you wanted. So it's really about kind of introducing ideas, I think, number one. I think number two is there's just so much interesting work in educational psychology that I read every day. And there's so many things that we take as given and kind of, oh, we know everything there is to know about X. And I just think that you can take any construct you're interested in and kind of scratch it a little bit further and think about, okay, well, what has to apply culture-wise comprehension? What has been taken for granted about it? What are the assumptions we have when we think about a motivation study or when we think about a reading comprehension study? And then start to interrogate those. And I think there's just so, so much work to be done there. Mm-hmm. And third, I think that if anybody read kind of the first version of the article that we submitted versus the final article, in a lot of ways, they're unrecognizable. So the beginnings of ideas were there, but we benefited so, 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 so much from the incredibly generous time, both of Jeff as a fantastic editor and three anonymous reviewers who really pushed us and asked critical questions to kind of, this is embarrassing to say in retrospect, but we started without having a clear definition of culture. Our first submission was just kind of a review of other people's definitions. And we kind of said, okay, these things could be culture, but let's say, see how they apply to text. And there was one reviewer who thankfully really pushed us like, well, how do you define culture? How do you define culture? And based on that review, we really realized that the way we wanted to think about culture was not as the static individual difference factor, was a little bit different than the way that it had been talked about in prior research. And so just from the perspective of having really smart people deeply engage with your ideas and give you feedback, just the editorial process itself, I think, is just tremendously beneficial. And it's one of those things where you don't know until you try. And so I would encourage everybody to think about writing an article. And when you have great collaborators, I think that's also really fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Just going on the line of not feeling intimidated, not only not feeling intimidated to write, but also to go beyond using sources that come from within the field of educational psychology. I think something that made it a little bit complicated, but that I really value from this manuscript, is that we integrated sources that go beyond what we traditionally cite in order to create something new, right? And I think educational psychology as a field has to start moving forward to just the traditional views that we have and push each other to create new ideas, create new views of seeing our field and putting that on paper and sharing it with others. And the only way we can do that is by engaging in what literally we just talk about, critical culturalized comprehension, and writing about it.
That's a great point. I really love everything you and Alex said. You know, ideally, the review process should be a conversation, right? So you're, as authors, in conversation with reviewers. And Gala, as you said, you're often in conversation with other literatures. And hopefully, like, that's a really dynamic and generative process that leads to, like, productive changes in your manuscript. And Alex, I don't think it's at all embarrassing, or whatever word you used, to say that, you know, a piece of your manuscript changed. In my experience, that happens all the time. And ideally, that's what a good writing and review process does. It kind of helps you flesh out some ideas and make a contribution. So I really appreciate everything you said. And I think it's very typical for most people that write a paper for educational psychologists. So I always like to ask what people are working on at the moment. You know, you get past this big paper for educational psychologists and you're on to the next thing. And I'm always curious, like, what are you working on now that's really exciting to you?
I can answer that because it's easier for me to brag about them maybe than it is for them to brag about themselves. So all of them have fantastic publications and projects at various stages that are all quite different, but I think would be of great interest to this audience. So going in author order, Gala is doing some really interesting theoretical and think aloud work with how graduate students engage in source-based writing. And Gala, maybe you can talk about this after I overview everybody. But to me, it's kind of reflective of this culturalized comprehension part, because she's really drawing on sociocultural theories also to ask questions about kind of how are we socialized into the writing process? How does the relationship between advisor and advisee shape what's written? Hanny is doing intervention work on evidence-based reasoning. And I think that connects to this paper because it's specifically focused on how evidence is presented in the popular press and how students kind of reason about evidence in everyday life. And she has a great paper on interventions that I believe is in CEP, correct me if I'm wrong. Hyeon is really interested in the role of self-regulation in learning from multiple texts. She's working on an educational psychologist paper. But if you want to see an empirical piece about that, it's also out in CEP, and it's looking at students' use of help-seeking resources. And Bailing is really interested in statistical reasoning, and in particular, how graduate students learn from statistical texts. And again, I see that connecting to this paper because it's thinking about statistical texts as these particular artifacts and as texts that we use somewhat differently than we use when we read a fiction book, right? If you're going to a statistical text, a lot of times you are trying to find a solution and you're bringing in particular components of your prior knowledge and thinking about how it applies to your problem. And I think that's really kind of an area that has been under-examined, and she's doing some think-alouds with that. So I think there's kind of really excellent and really varied work. One project that we're working on together that's under review, but will hopefully be out soon, and I think is kind of a more close extension of this paper, is focusing on students' engagement in critique. So that idea of critical culturalized comprehension of when you read a text and you don't just assimilate what it says, but you really question kind of, what is it saying? Do I agree with what it's saying? And if you disagree, for us, critique is more than just evaluation to say, I don't like this or I disagree, but really affirmatively specifying what is a limitation and thinking about where that limitation may come from. And we're looking at it within the context of students reading popular press texts that have marginalizing, we call them hegemonic narratives. So there's one that is looking at a discussion of land development that has kind of very NIMBY, kind of not in my backyard, very kind of classist arguments. And we're looking at, are students able to, number one, recognize them when they encounter them? And number two, are they able to reject them? Kind of, do they understand what's happening? And to us, that gets at the core of what we hope the construct of comprehension is broadened to be. So not just kind of understanding the meaning of text, but really understanding that texts inform our worldview. And so it's really important for students to think about, what are the values being communicated through texts? Do I agree with them? And if I don't, what is a different narrative that I can tell that's more affirming of my values?
Great. Dalla, did you want to add anything to what Alex said?
Yeah, I worked on some think aloud data, and then after that, I still had the question of, so what? What's happening in writing? So I interviewed a couple of grad students in EdSych, and after that, I noticed a lot of like power dynamics going on in writing. And so now the next stage is interviewing some advisors of EdSych. So yeah, I'm on that process of going from think aloud to interviewing one side of the coin and interviewing another side of the coin, and looking at those sociocultural interactions, the role of emotion in writing and selecting of information as well. So yeah, that's a little bit of an overview of what I'm currently working on.
So, you know, it sounds like you're not busy at all. Of course, I'm kidding. That's a lot of things happening. It all sounds really exciting. And so much of it comes from your article, which is another great reason for our listeners to check out your article. So I really encourage them to get the 2024 issue one of Educational Psychologists and read your article entitled Critical Culturalized Comprehension, Exploring Culture as Learners Thinking About Texts. So Alex, Gala, Hani, Hyeon, and Bailing, thank you so much for talking to me today about your article.
Thank you so much for having us.
And finally, to you, our listener, if you've enjoyed this podcast, please check out our other episodes on your favorite podcast app and consider rating and reviewing us. You can also go to our APA Division 15 website, where all of our podcasts are linked in the publications section. So thanks again for listening.